This is the third day of this December 2008 four-day session. And we'll return to the teachings of the 16th century Chinese Zen master Zibo, reading from the book Zibo, the Last Great Zen Master of China, by J.C. Cleary. Reality, nature, is like water. Feelings are like ice. Ice is a solid obstruction. Water is fluid and flows through. Free-flowing, it is fundamentally without subject and object. As a solid obstruction, sense faculties and sense objects are in opposition. This is the problem with talking about Zen, is that it's so subtle, really, in the end. It's so subtle that it takes quite sophisticated vocabulary, often philosophical words or very abstract words like this, in order to describe it. But as we know, it's nothing to do with philosophy or abstraction. It's just direct experience. But in talking about it, we get tangled up in this kind of constructions. Let's see if we can break this down and make it more clear. Reality, nature is like water, flowing without any fixed form to, without any substance, unchanging substance to it. Reality nature, what the translator makes reality nature, is rather nothing that can be grasped. Just as water cannot be grasped, and our true nature is endlessly accommodating, just as water accommodates itself to the shape of its container, so too our true nature has this mutable and accommodating quality to it. Then he says, feelings are like ice. Ice is a solid obstruction. Water is fluid and flows through. Now, for people who feel that feelings are the ultimate truth, this can be disturbing to hear this. But what he's really saying is that feelings that arise from self and other, the notion of self and other, such as anger, for example. This is what creates obstructions. To feel is part of being human, of course. We're not insensate. We feel things. We feel things physically, and we feel things emotionally. But those feelings that are based on self and other do create problems in blocking our ability to flow and just selflessly adapt to circumstances. And by the way, feelings are not the ground of our mind. They're not the ultimate. Feelings are like thoughts in that they come and go. In that sense, they're like the clouds. They're not the clear blue sky behind the clouds. They're all in the nature of phenomena. Now, phenomena, like any phenomena, feelings need to be worked with and understood, but they're not the in any sense the ultimate truth. And then he goes on, free-flowing, referring to water, free-flowing, it is fundamentally without subject and object. And then he says, there is knowing these meanings, and there is awakening to these meanings. With knowing, the ideas are understood, but in contact with things and events, there is still delusion. With awakening, in contact with things and events, you understand their inner truth, that sentiments and sense objects are of themselves empty. Delusion is the entanglement of feelings. Awakening is meshing with reality nature. Entanglement means duality. Meshing means oneness. Again, this is very dense material here. Let's go back. With knowing, the ideas are understood, but in contact with things and events, there is still delusion. This is where we understand something in our heads, but then in the daily circumstances, coming into interpersonal friction or the strain of adverse circumstances, whether it's weather or any other kind of conditions, this understanding that we have conceptually fails us, and our habit forces instead get the upper hand, and we react to people and circumstances in ways that are deluded because they're based on our own egoistic preferences. Delusion is the entanglement of feelings based on subject and object, self and other. Awakening is meshing with reality nature, our true nature, let's put it that way. Entanglement means duality. Meshing means oneness. Meshing or merging or joining with, this is the work of Zen. Not separating, but joining with. Duality implies relativity. Oneness implies birthlessness. In other words, that which is beyond birth and death, beyond arising and disappearing, beyond coming and going. Birthlessness is the constant principle of reality nature. Relativity is the transformation of reality nature. Constancy is selfless and luminous. Transformation means having sentiments and being dimmed. Well, here again, let's try to decipher this. Transformation in this context, as he's using it, or as the translator is using it, would mean it implies two-ness. Opposition, let's say, from this to that. And in the realm of two-ness, that's the relative, the world, the conventional reality that every Tom, Dick, and Harry knows about. This is something that is entirely different from the constancy and the oneness and the birthlessness that he's referring to. He goes on, thus knowledge within darkness cannot vanquish the darkness. So then the path is no match for habitual actions. Okay, knowledge within darkness cannot vanquish the darkness. One way to understand this is that when we get into a realm that we have not integrated into our understanding through direct experience, then our habit forces, our conditioning, our karma prevails. It's all about the direct experience, and then integrating that into the body. Anything that's not integrated into the body is not really understood. This is a fundamental premise. This is why in Doksan, those who are working on a koan need to physically demonstrate it, because otherwise you can talk a good game, you can if you have a certain intellectual or conceptual facility with words, you can outline it quite nicely, but that's not the same as real understanding. Thus, knowledge within darkness cannot vanquish the darkness, so then the path is no match for habitual actions. With luminosity, habitual actions do not get the better of awareness, so that without depending on cultivation, one directly enters enlightenment. Otherwise, even if you relinquish countless bodies and lives, it just adds to the karma of contrived activity. This is because awakening is close to immediate awareness, while knowing is close to comparative awareness. Well, there's a footnote here. I don't know that it's necessary. We know just intuitively what these terms mean, immediate awareness and comparative awareness. But just to, come from a sutra that gives a full treatment of these categories. Immediate awareness directly apprehends the inherent essence, what words cannot reach, what provisional knowledge cannot link up with. Only immediate awareness reaches reality. Comparative awareness is based on discrimination and clinging to the forms of things. It works by comparing, judging, and categorizing. I have to take a drink of water after those two paragraphs. Get back to direct experience. Here's the next one. Oh, I did that yesterday. Ancients were concerned about the way the world's people make food and drink and sex their chief desires. They wish to correct this. They here, it seems, refers to the people, the world's people. They wish to correct this, little knowing that they were worrying about only one side of the problem, not worrying about both sides. If not for the knowing subject, there would be no basis for taking pleasure in food and drink and sex. To worry about the objects of knowledge without worrying about the knowing subject is to ignore the parallelism. As I understand this, what he's saying is that dwelling on our attachments, and yesterday we listed five of them, the five desires. Food and drink is one, sex, wealth, sleep, and whatever the fifth was.
Fame.
What's that?
Fame.
Thank you. Dwelling on our attachments is not a way to get free of them. The way to get free of them is to dwell on the one that sees those attachments. And that one can be formulated in different ways. Mu, who, what. It doesn't help. This is an absolutely crucial thing that we eventually learn through enough struggle in Sesshin. It does not help to fixate on our defilements, which are exposed in Zazen. This is one of the most painful things about Sesshin, is to have these egoistic attachments of ours, the pettiness, the anger, the jealousy, the resentment, and on and on and on. To have these exposed in Sesshin is painful. But the worst thing we could do when we see these things arise in the mind is to then linger there and do anything with them, analyze them, or have any kind of negative feelings toward them. It's enough just to see them. There they are. Anger, for example. Okay, mu. Okay, you've seen it. You've seen the defilement. Mu. Or, what is it? What is it? Who? Who is seeing? Who's angry? So each of these practices returns, takes the mind off the self as object. Look at me, look at what an awful person I am, look at this, look at that, or the opposite, look at what a great person, superior, outstanding, talented person I am. We take our attention off the self as object and return it to that which is perceiving that supposed self out there. The knowing subject is hard to smash because habits have gelled into second nature. It is like oil put into flour. Unless you can penetrate through to fundamental mind and use the luminous, selfless one to deal with habits, the oil will never be taken out of the flour. So this self as subject is no self. We say it in the Hakuin chant. Our true self is no self. Our own self is no self. These days, those whom the world knows as expounders of the path, must be referring to other teachers, do not realize that the knowing subject is a thief. So here it's the small s self. They feed and foster it inordinately and mightily help it grow. The so-called selfless luminous one remains forever dormant and is never unfurled. What's worse, they accept the knowing subject as their master and consider that it sees reality nature, that it is innate awareness. Alas, they are calling the slave the free one. What could be worse? This is the trouble with using terms like our big self or small, this big self, small self thing that became so, it was introduced in one of the first books on Zen, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's because then you reify this big self and it becomes another object. What is that one? Who is that one? What is Mu? And then we make a concept out of it. We don't have two selves. There's just this one. Here's another chapter. The poor long for wealth. The wealthy long for noble rank. The nobility long for security and ease. Those secure and at ease long for immortality. It's never enough. No matter what we have, we want more. Little do they realize that from longing comes having birth. From birth comes riches and nobility, poverty and low station, security and ease, and also all forms of existence and suffering, continuing inexhaustibly. Therefore, if you want to cross the sea of suffering, you must take the boat of having no longings. Only then can you climb up onto that other shore. This is this fundamental understanding in Buddhism that we will always be dissatisfied so long as we rely on things of the world for our contentment. Things of the world meaning all of these things, wealth, power, physical security, success. So it's just a moving toward greater intelligence to recognize that since we will never be able to acquire everything that will make us satisfied, the better approach is to see through this habit of craving, of wanting ever more. Much more intelligent. This, when I say intelligent, I mean our native intelligence, our intelligence with a capital I. He goes on, but longing cannot nullify itself. In order to nullify longing, you must hear the path. The path cannot be heard by itself. Here, too, you must depend on causal conditions to draw you to it. Then it will be heard. Causal conditions are truly the mother of all the Buddhas, the teachers who sustain sentient beings. It's an interesting way to frame this. That in the end, it really comes down to our karma, whether or not we come into contact with the Dharma and whether we then follow it, practice it, and even realize it. This is what I find so fascinating about hearing people's stories of how they came to Zen. No two stories are the same, and they're often really just so intriguing, and the twists and turns, the things that happen, that you look back and say, if I hadn't done that, if that hadn't happened to me, then who knows? We never know, but in retrospect, when we look back, we see how each thing had its, played its role in getting us here. The path cannot be heard by itself. You must depend on causal conditions to draw you to it. Then it will be heard. Causal conditions are truly the mother of all the Buddhas. This is why in new student ceremonies, I always invite the new students to write out a brief biography of whatever they think may have been instrumental, anything in their life that may have been instrumental to bring them to Zen. And that often means the pains, the losses that we suffer. And I am just astonished at how many people in the Sangha have suffered so much in ways that I didn't know till I read these accounts. And then he gives some examples of how we can encounter things, people, circumstances that turn us toward this path. Taking marks of goodness as the causal basis means, for example, beholding the countenance of a virtuous person and having one's meanness and pettiness spontaneously dissolve. So just seeing someone with long training, discipline, whose life has been based on self-discipline, can open one's mind to the path. And then taking sound as the causal basis means, for example, the mind ground opening through under the impact of a single word. Other things, too, can be taken as the causal basis. The teachings of the sages, great enlightened teachers, good friends and Dharma companions, adverse situations, favorable situations. Thus it is said, the seed of enlightenment arises from causal conditions. It's another. I assume that these are letters, especially given the language, the kind of dense language that these were written letters. Generally, people pay back their parents' virtue by making offerings of food on prescribed occasions. But they are only increasing their black karma. Worldly conventional people are benighted and blind. It is always hard to explain the true principle to them. Now, I take this to be the Confucian rituals of showing gratitude and respect to one's deceased parents by making offerings of food on the certain days that it's prescribed. And here, Zibo is saying, "Nah, don't think that's gonna do the trick." Just obediently going along with convention. He goes on, temporarily going along with their customs and practices to make them happy, the sage worthies realize that their habits are not easily changed. Now, he's referring then to those of understanding, teachers and others, who participate in such conventions, even if they're Confucian rituals. That these people, these teachers realize that their habits are not easily changed. Provisionally floating and sinking along with them, the sages use inner truth to cut away their sentiments, working in the shadows, secretly taming and tempering them. After long effort, the power is sufficient, and their habits change by themselves. Those who are undergoing the tempering are oblivious to why it is so. Thus, the sages share the vicissitudes of social forms. If they didn't rejoice at what the conventional people celebrate, if they didn't offer condolences when the conventional people mourn, this would mean bitter feelings against the sages. So this is a skillful means he's talking about. Accommodating oneself to the habits, the customs, the conventions that people have been conditioned to rely on, doing this as a way of being able to reach the person better, to be able to influence the person better. Roshi Kaplow used to say it in a very, very neat way. He would say, sometimes you have to give people what they want in order for them to want to give you what you have. I think back, this being the season, I think back to in the early 70s when we would have a Christmas tree in the link at the center. And there are a number of things that of this category. There's an old saying, the missionary, a wise missionary, will allow the natives to keep their statues under the bed. Then he says, nevertheless, if the sages did not use the light of supreme compassion to illuminate the dark confusion of conventional people, they would be stuck there and be forever relegated among the unsalvageable. How could this be the fundamental mental state of these people? If we want to illuminate their dark confusion, for the living it is best that we purify our own conduct. And for the dead, I think you're going back to those rituals for deceased relatives, and for the dead, it is simplest and most beneficial that we recite Vishvabhu Buddha's verse. The footnote tells us, we know the name Vishvabhu Buddha from our ancestral line. The footnote says Vishvabhu is one of the so-called seven ancient Buddhas, predecessors to Shakyamuni and the Chan ancestors, whose transmission verses lead off the transmission of the lamp. I think Zeebo here is not demeaning social conventions so much as he is emphasizing that liberation, true liberation, does not come from burning incense and these other things. And yet, these are often called secondary practices, chanting, devotions, and so forth, these all have their place, as long as we don't imagine, rely on these good works or conventions to free us from birth and death. He goes on, when habitual practices are deep-rooted, they are hard to remold even with heaven and earth as the furnace, yin and yang as the fuel, a whirlwind for a bellows, and the Creator's power. What Creator could he be talking about? Thus the Buddha used the water of emptiness to wash them away. This means seeing that all of these things are ultimately without any substantiality to them. Seeing through forms, seeing through the things of the world, and seeing through, in particular, seeing through our own habit forces. This is the most important thing that we can do in coming to terms with and resolving our defilements, our shortcomings, is to see that they have no roots. To see that, in other words, fundamentally, they are empty, devoid of any self-substance, any permanent nature to them. They're like flowers in the air. If we press our thumb against our eye, then take it off and open our eye, momentarily we have these little, what the ancients call flowers, these little marks that we see in our field of vision. They're not there. We see them, but they're not there. Once having seen through form, which includes all phenomena, thoughts, habit patterns, once having seen through them, even though they may continue. We may still have to deal with these habit forces. We don't see them in the same way. They aren't the same kind of menace that they were originally. We don't see ourselves at war with them. They're just patterns of energy that have this staying power that can be actually quite amazing. Seeing through them, seeing through form, enables us not to waste time fighting them or despising them, just seeing them as traces. Yeah, my wife, who goes to Vipassana retreats occasionally, she came back and shared one of the images they use that she and then I found quite appealing in this regard is the referring. They said you can see your these defilements, these habit patterns, as just a pet that you're walking along with on a leash. You know, there it is. You don't have to get into a big drama over your pet that you're leading on the leash. You don't want, though, you don't want the pet to be leading you on the leash. He goes on, the means by which sentient beings go wrong is no more than desire for food and drink and sex. With proper use, they become good fortune. If you do not achieve the proper use of them, they become false. Being false, what they incur is nothing but suffering. With suffering, the spirit is agitated and alarmed, and the soul is turned upside down. You have to wonder here about the translation, distinguishing between spirit and soul. Maybe he used those terms. Maybe he would be, Zeebo would be satisfied with that translation, but you have to wonder. Now, the way this starts off, the means by which sentient beings go wrong is no more than desire for food and drink and sex. And you think, okay. And then he says, with proper use, they become good fortune. He goes on, little do people realize that before anger and joy arise, they are the same as the Buddhas and ancestral teachers. They, meaning those who have strong emotional reactions. If they go wrong with anger, they become asuras. These are one of the six realms of unenlightened existence, those called fighting demons, asuras, or those who are caught in rivalry and competition. If they go wrong with anger, they become asuras. If they go wrong with ignorance, they become animals. If they go wrong with greed, they become hungry ghosts. If they go wrong with evil, they become hell beings. Devas and humans are so, these are the two highest levels of unenlightened existence, devas and humans are so by means of the 10 virtues and the 5 precepts. These are the so-called 6 paths. I guess he's saying in the case of devas and humans that we land in these two privileged realms by virtue of having upheld, more or less, the 5 precepts, the first 5 precepts. Killing, stealing, sexual misconduct, lying, and abuse of substances, refraining from all those. He's mixing here the three poisons with the 6 realms of existence, but never mind. Nevertheless, a deva who does not awaken can become a human. That would be one notch down. A human who does not awaken can become an animal. With such a multitude of faults, it would be impossible for them to return to their true state without using the water of emptiness to wash them away. So once we have reached one of these realms of unenlightened existence, then the way to get bumped up or beyond, the way to vault over all six of them, even the highest, is to realize the emptiness of all such forms, all such ranks and categories. Well, our time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows.